pre-exilic and the prophets that were anti or past or, be, or after the exile. And so we do have prophets after they return from Babylonian captivity. And the last of these prophets is Micah, Malachi. That's the last book, right? And Malachi, if we were to read, we actually did a study of Malachi a couple years ago, and Malachi sort of reports the spiritual condition of the people when he's writing. So they've been back and the temple is rebuilt, and you might expect that after having been spanked in captivity, the children of Israel would have learned their lesson and become more devout. But Malachi records that they are listless and mechanical in their worship. In other words, they went through the motions. They had a custom and a command to meet on the Sabbath, and so if I'm a good Jew, I'm going to meet at the Sabbath. But they were also commanded to bring sacrifices for their sin, and what sort of animals were they to bring? Unblemished, perfect animals. Why? Because God wanted to rob them of their most profitable produce. Is that the idea? Suffer, you guys. I want the best that you have. Well, they should want to, but they didn't. This points to Christ, who was unblemished. Because God's requirement of a perfect sacrifice foreshadowed his perfect sacrifice. When I was a kid, the first suit that my parents bought me was for what purpose? Going to church on Sunday. And to tell you the truth, well, actually, I was going to say that's the only time I wore it, but that's not true. I can remember the day, Dee is smiling, I can remember the day that if you went out to a restaurant to eat, you would dress up in a suit. Does anyone remember these days? So we had to wear a suit to church on Sunday. Why? What did your pastor tell you growing up why you should dress well for church on Sunday?
If the Lord was there, Jesus was there.
Don't get in trouble by what you say, Tony.
No, I mean, if he was there, how would you want to present?
Don't say if Jesus were there. He is there. But you're getting at the right point. Again, maybe you know, everyone's a victim of their own upbringing. So the thing that got drummed into my head with this is God gave us his best. Therefore, we give him our best. And can you see the reflection on the practice of the sacrifice in the Old Testament? Why should they give God their best sacrifice? Because they were looking forward to God giving them his best. And if you act mirroring God, what is starting to be built in you? If you act mirroring God, what is starting to be built in you?
God's image.
Does any parent teach his children to talk so that they can speak a foreign language? How many of you taught your children to teach to speak German when they were learning to talk? If Crystal were here, she'd probably... There are some, because that was the parental language. We teach them to be like us in manner, custom, and in all ways. They are in our image. And inasmuch as we have a good image, that's good. And since we're sinful, we pass along some bad things too. But God wants his children to be in his image. As God acts, he wants them to act. And their unwillingness to bring a perfect sacrifice indicated the common fallen human trait of being greedy, of wanting the best for themselves, of wanting to get the top price for what their produce was selling. And that was more important to them than giving God their best. So someone said they should have wanted to, and you're right. But why? Because God has given us his best. Are you going to tell us what your parents told you about? Well, again, if I can add to that, one of the other main things about this last book of the Old Testament, Malachi, is that you can sense in Malachi's writings, and it's really great. You should. It's not a long book. I think it's only four chapters. Read Malachi is really a great book, and if you want to challenge yourself to get into reading, it's a nice baby step. Four chapters. Of course, there's also the book of Jude, but that's a little cryptic. But in Malachi, you sense in Malachi's words the frustrations that there were a remnant among the people of Israel that were seeing all of this and becoming very frustrated with it. And there's a dialogue in Malachi in which he's saying to the people, don't tell yourself that being pious and following God and his word is worthless because the evil seem to prosper and those who are doing the right thing are always getting the shaft, if I could say it in a crude way, or getting the evil. You do good, and what's the old saying? No good deed goes unpunished, right? So he's saying, don't give up on that because a day of reckoning is coming. And those who have done evil, you will tread under your feet. And again, we don't like vindictive language, but the fact is, that the pious are always oppressed and offended, both outside the church and inside the church, at impious people. People who want to be believers, who say they want to be believers, but won't for a minute act like it. And sometimes they get weight. I'm not talking about our congregation, but everyone's been in congregation where ungodly people throw their weight around in the congregation. And they're allowed to do it. And people look at it and go, how can this happen in the house of God? Why does God allow this to happen? It's always the same. It happened in Malachi's day. And what it's saying is, don't worry. Hang in there. Don't give up. Their reward is now. And their future reward is not worth aspiring to. There will be a turnaround. And those that sinned impudently and impenitently will suffer forever and ever. And you who bore with their offense quietly and patiently will be given everything that your heart desires. But don't give up. Now, the reason I'm saying that is that the trajectory, even though God had brought the people back from captivity, the spiritual trajectory for the Jews was not going in a good direction. And this is testified by these latter prophets. And then there's a period of about 450 years between the writing of Malachi and the appearance of Christ in the New Testament. And we call that period of 400 to 450 years the time of intertestamental silence. Now, you want to find out what happened? Get yourself an Apocrypha. In the Roman Catholic Bible and in early Lutheran Bibles, there was a section of the Bible called the Apocrypha besides the Old and the New Testament. And in it is recorded much history that took place before Jesus. If you want to find out who the Pharisees were and why they were given such a good reputation and looked at as heroes among the Jews, you have to read the history that went in between. And just to capsulize that history, Alexander the Great came after the Babylonian captivity, and he conquered Greece all the way to Asia. He had a fantastic empire, which included the Holy Lands, the land of the Jews. So the Jews during the intertestamental period were under the Greeks. When Alexander the Great died, his empire was divided into four parts under his four generals. And so it was a tetrarchy, which means four heads. And the head of Israel, the one in charge, was a Greek general by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes. And the Greeks collected gods. If you go to Greece, you'll find a panoply of gods being worshipped. Part of Alexander's genius was that when he conquered a land, he allowed them to keep their culture and their religion as much as possible, and to infiltrate Greek culture when it was helpful. And Greek culture was attractive, so by the fact that people saw what was good in Greek culture, you know, literacy and wisdom and that sort of thing, the Greek culture spread, not so much by imposition, but because it was superior. And they would not remove the false gods. But that policy changed when they got to the Jews and the Holy Land. Can anyone propose a reason why? Yes, exactly. Well stated, precisely stated. Because the Jews demanded exclusivity. The Jews said there are, see, other gods will coexist if you just sort of ignore them and say, oh, that's your God, that's fine, this is my God, that's fine. But if you have a theology that says, no, there is only one God, and this is the true God, and all others are false gods, now you got a troublemaker in the kingdom. And that's what the Jews were. And Antiochus Epiphanes was determined to break them. It wasn't over, well, it was over a wall of religion. The Jews wanted a wall, and the Gentiles wanted no wall, open borders. Well, it's amazing. There is sort of a parallel. There is a parallel, and it's no parallel at all. But what did he do then? He said, I'm going to break them. And so he persecuted them. And I think it was the Greeks. It may have been the Romans. But one of those occupying powers at one time outlawed the religion. And it was the Pharisees that stood up publicly and saying, we're not going to abide by this law. And in one day they crucified 800 Pharisees. Pharisees. Now do you understand why they were thought of as heroes? And in a certain sense, I guess they were. What?
The Pharisees.
We should also say what a Pharisee is. Pharisee comes from the Hebrew word parush, which means pure. And after the captivity, there was a group of godly, you might say godly, I would say, well, they're like a lot like some fundamentalists in America today. They looked at the priesthood and said, the priests are allowing all this junk to happen in the temple, and they themselves are setting a bad example. So the Pharisees said, since the priests ain't doing it, we will. And so they set out to proselytize, to convert people to Judaism, and to teach the Old Testament. And they called themselves the Pharisees, the pure ones. And they believed that if they could be pure enough and do God's will, their good works would bring on the Messianic kingdom. God would reward them for their righteousness and bring the kingdom to bear. That was their theology and their roots. So Antiochus Epiphanes wants to break them. He does some martyrdom. There are some Jewish rebels that take arms against the Greeks and the Romans. They're always squashed and quelled because they're never strong enough. But Antiochus Epiphanes finally says, I'm going to put an end to this stuff. What's their most sacred teaching? Well, that God dwells in the Holy of Holies in the temples, and that's their sacred space. a priest can only enter their Holy of Holies one time a year on the Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And says Antiochus says, oh, that's great, okay. So he takes a statue of Zeus, the highest false god in the Greek panoply. He marches into the temple. He goes behind the curtain into the Holy of Holies and puts the statue on the Holy of Holies. And the Jews were decimated. How could God allow that to happen? Remember the priest when he went in there wore a rope around his ankle in case he displeased God and they had to drag him out on the Day of Atonement?
I just read an article that said that was false.
What was false?
That they didn't do that.
That who didn't do what?
Didn't,
I don't know. Fine. Whatever.
Fake news.
Well, one of them is fake news, obviously. But the piety that points to was there. So, what's the Hanukkah? This is where Hanukkah comes from. When finally they repelled the Jews or the Greeks and got control of the temple after the Romans took over again and it was safe to do so, they wanted to re-sanctify the temple, to clean it out again and use it for sacrifice as God had commanded. And in the temple, God had commanded that there was a special kind of priestly oil that had to be burned in the lampstands of the temple and no other kind of oil could be used. And it would take a week or two to produce that, and they found a jar of it, but it was only enough to light the lamps for one day. And so they divided it and loaded up the lamps, and they burned for 7 days. And that's the miracle of lights that the Jews celebrate in Hanukkah. So all this is in the intertestamental period. Then the Romans come and defeat the Greeks, and the Romans are in charge. And the Romans also had a republic and a representative type of government, and so local rulers were also appointed. And so in addition to the governor, Quirinius was governor of Syria at the time of Jesus' birth. At the time, there would be a Roman governor, but also a Jewish king. And at Jesus' birth, who's the king?
Herod.
And remember, this is Herod the Great. And he was great. He was a great politician. It was hard for him to assume power. He was not of the Davidic line, so he was, according to Scripture, an illegitimate king. But he held power with an iron fist. He squashed the opposition, both with intrigue, palace intrigue, and with raw power. He's also noted in the Roman Empire as being one of the greatest builders in the empire. It was Herod the Great that restored King Solomon's temple, and that's a grand thing. But he also built Masada and several of the other things that have been recently excavated in the area of the Holy Land. All that was Herod the Great. Josephus records the death of Herod the Great. Anyone know how he died? His guts spilled out, which is also similar to how Judas's death is portrayed in the book of Acts. So his bowels gushed out and he died. Now that's Herod the Great. We should keep in mind historically also that Herod the Great, the king at the time of Jesus' birth, is not the same Herod that calls for Jesus on the day of his execution and puts him on trial. That's Herod the Great's son, Herod the Tetrarch. Because when Herod died, he divided the kingdom among his four sons. And Herod Jr. got Jerusalem and the temple. So take out a blank sheet of paper. Put your name on it. No. The first event that we are going to look at in the New Testament is the announcement of a birth that takes place in Luke chapter 1. And if we were to open our Bibles to Luke 1, we would see that Luke, who is the one who wrote this gospel, says that he carefully researched the things that he was writing. Luke was not one of the 12 disciples, but we come across Luke in St. Paul's missionary journeys. In his first missionary journey, Paul was stoned and left for dead in Asia Minor. And in his second journey, which happened some years later, we find that he sort of enlists the help of a physician named Luke. He is a Greek person who is a doctor. And it may well be that Paul needed a doctor in his travels. Yes. Well, God does provide in many ways. But Luke is also not a Jew of background, so he's a Greek. And his Greek is a little bit different than the apostles, just out of style considerations, because he's an educated man, unlike the apostles, who are all fishermen and men of lower or middle class, and he's the physician. Luke also wrote the book of Acts. And so Luke says he carefully researched these things. And I think if you read through the Gospel of Luke, it's a pretty logical conclusion to make that he must have spoken to Mary, Jesus' mother. Because there's a genealogy in Luke that may well be Mary's genealogy, whereas Matthew is Joseph's genealogy. And there's so much personal things, many personal things about Mary that Luke adds. And even the Magnificat, which is Mary's song in visiting Elizabeth, is given to us by Luke. And as we're going to be looking here at a liturgical verse that we still use in this first chapter of Luke, we would give credit to Luke as being one of the gospel writers that appears a lot in our liturgy. And so we pick up a lot from Luke in the life of the church. So picking it up there, lest we only have 10 minutes, maybe we should just save it for next week. But that might be a good idea. Let's just read through it once this week, and then that'll give us a springboard into next week. And I apologize to you with history, because I'm boring you with history.
No, that was good.
No, the reason I say that is I myself, when I was in undergraduate, I took ancient Roman history, and we so disrespectfully, we had an old prof, University of Wisconsin, he stood on a box and he read cards about Roman history, and he'd flip the card every once in a while, even though he never looked at them. He had the whole thing memorized. But it was so boring, we said, oh, old Edson must have lived back then. But I confess a hatred for history. It was all dates and memorization until I got to seminary, and then I learned to love history. University of Wisconsin made me love literature, and the seminary made me love history. So again, if I'm boring you with history, I am compassionate with you. I was where you sat. But when it's history, H-I-S, capital H-I-S, his story, then history is relevant to us all. And it is eternal history, because the people in that history, some of them, by God's grace, we are going to see in heaven. And I can't wait to see them. I got a lot of questions. Yes?
As long as we're dwelling on history, then. Were the Maccabees Christian, as far as we know?
The Judas Maccabeus?
Christian in the sense of looking forward to the Christ and faithful in that sense rather than something else.
In a sense, and again, maybe you want to ask another question in case I'm way off the mark of where you're going, but all of the factions in Judaism were looking for the Messiah. They all were. Maybe with the exception of the priests in the temples. The many of the priests of in the temples were very much like the liberal Christians in our day. They believed it was all myth. They didn't believe in the literality of all of it. And they believed that the only benefit of religion is that it makes people's lives better now. The Sadducees and the workers in the temple did not believe in a resurrection. They only believed that the only benefit of religion was here and now. But so they all had their picture of who the Messiah was and how he was going to come. They all looked for the Messiah, but their vision of the Messiah differed in many ways, and what would pave the way for the Messiah differed in many ways. The Maccabeans, if I'm getting my history right, and correct me if I'm wrong, were a militant group. Judas Maccabeus was one of the military leaders that was rebellious against the occupying forces. They believed they had a righteous cause, but they weren't in God's plan. Did you want to ask another question? Or?
No.
Okay. Well, they were like the Pharisees in that I believe that the battle that they were fighting was their idea of how to bring the Messiah in. The Pharisees fought the battle with the word, to their credit. The Maccabeans fought it with the sword. God fought it with Christ. So, okay. We won't even read this then. You would do me a favor, save some ink and paper if you would fold this up and put it in your materials and bring it next week. And again, I apologize if we were way off base, but sometimes it's good to tie those two testaments together somewhere. Karen, did you have something?
I'm going to let you bring it next week.
Let's pick up that question next week.